Kent, John Rivette, continuing, I don't know the interview number, but at some point, hopefully in the last week, you received a tape on your interview with Les Washburn?
Yes, I did.
Good.
Yes.
So I'm glad.
Thank you. Thank you for sending that.
Well, we'll thank Lisa Fine for finding it and getting that to the Voice Library, and they made a copy for you and a copy for me. And I was very excited after we've talked about trying to find that for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
So for today, I was going to start by asking you if you had any comments about that or any other lasting ones about corruption, which is where we ended, then go into the IUD coordinated bargaining experiences. Then we talked about some innovations by AIW, whether it was in bargaining, pensions, health and safety, so on and so forth, or outreach efforts to members dealing with issues about racial justice internal to the union and in contracts, so on and so forth, and then about, depending on how far we get to the more recent times in terms of sort of following your years there, the mergers with paper and then steel. Does that sound like what you think we're at?
Sure, sure.
Okay.
And I honestly don't recall how far we got into the corruption. I thought we had done that pretty well, did we not?
I think we did. I didn't know if, you know, after I finished talking to you or other people, sometimes then I think of something else and say, well, I wished I had asked about this or that. So I didn't know if you felt like we didn't quite finish. I thought we had.
Yeah, I did too. I mean,
it was really,
I think, a rather landmark action by the union, because they were the only one of all those that were kicked out of the AFL-CIO in 1957 who were back in within just a few months. You know, the others held out for a long time, and some never, you know, did come back, and of course were then merged into other things later on. But, you know, I think it was an example of where the more honest and hardworking trade unionists just took the bull by the horns, so to speak, aided and assisted by, of course, the AFL-CIO's sanctions. That certainly helped spur them on to really get back into the house of labor and to take those actions that, you know, truly cleansed the union. And George Meany had a strong role in that deal. He had... I know from conversations that I had with Dominic D'Ambrosio and a few others and of course Carl Griebentrog, who is long deceased and was the president from the merger convention on until 1971, I believe. Carl always said that when Gabe was, this is Jewel, was, mm-hmm. you know, one of the few of the older, of the previous officers who was kept on. And the AFL-CIO, and particularly George Meany, were not happy about that because they associated Gabe too much with Earl Heaton, who had been the previous president during the corrupt era. Not that either Gabe or Earl were corrupt themselves, but they had, you know, pretty much permitted or watched that stuff go on without trying to stop it. So, but anyway, Gabe did turn out to be a very excellent secretary treasurer and, you know, president, and was by himself a very, very principled and really smart guy.
So
that was, I think the only point we have to stress there is that it isn't an example of how, you know, certain, in a sense, rank and file officers, aided by certain key directors, you know, really did regain control of the union and, you know, kind of took care of it. Because one of the conditions, and I don't know if I mentioned this in the previous interview, was that they moved the headquarters back to Milwaukee from Los Angeles. And I know, for instance, people like Gabe, because I had talked with Gabe years later about that. He was somewhat opposed to the move back to Milwaukee because he thought the move to Los Angeles was good because he saw all sorts of future out on the West Coast for the union. Unfortunately, the union had very little toehold in California, and you know, never was able to grow a great deal out there. He felt that moving back to Milwaukee and you know, into kind of retrenching and becoming more of a Midwest-based union, which we indeed turned out to be, was a mistake. And that's a bona fide argument, which, you know, you can look at either way. But anyway, we came back to Milwaukee, and with Carl Griebentrug at the head, who still kind of spoke with a guttural German accent, although he was born in North Dakota. And I think if you know the accents of folks in places like North Dakota and rural Wisconsin and Minnesota, you know,
right.
they can be rather foreign sounding. So, but you know, Carl was an old skilled tradesman in a way, and you know, really, and so anyway, that's, and then we move forward from that period.
Three real quick things before we move forward. You said Vegas, but you were talking about Los Angeles, right?
Oh, I don't mean Vegas. I meant Los Angeles. Right. Actually, our headquarters was, and there are pictures of it, and you'll be shocked. They were on Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills. That was our goddamn address. Can you imagine that for you?
I've seen that in lots of materials, and that's why I jotted that down, because you said Vegas for a second.
Yeah, no way.
And I knew it was Los Angeles and that street. Why Milwaukee? If someone, you know, in the future, if we get this written up or do something and want to say, why is AIW in Milwaukee, what would be the answer to that?
Well, part of it was Carl Griebentrug's choice, because he was basically from West Bend. I mean, he was born in North Dakota, but as a boy moved to West Bend, which is 35 miles northwest of Milwaukee, and he had been the regional director of Region 9, which is based in Milwaukee. He had his home in Milwaukee, and so forth. So I think it was that, and the fact that we had been in Milwaukee from 1943 to about 1954 when we moved out to Los Angeles.
I was curious if it was also because of the extent that AIW had auto parts supply and many things related to auto, and auto was so concentrated in the Midwest in those years.
Well, yeah, no, we had all of the, you know, so many of the auto parts, you know, factories in the Midwest. There is no question about it. Milwaukee also, you know, we had a lot of members here. And in fact, the old UAW Local 75, which was located up at Seaman Body, which made bodies for Nash and you know, for the, and then later for American Motors, which had their assembly plant in Kenosha. And that particular local was quite strong for the AFL side of the UAW, you know, during the split period. And so there was a lot of strong feeling for the union here in the area. And we were big up there. Carl had really helped grow that whole area up there around West Bend, which between West Bend and Manitowoc and a few other, Chilton and a few other cities up there, they probably produced as many pots and pans for the country, for the world maybe, from the 1940s into probably the 80s. I mean, you, for instance, Merrill Aluminum was in Manitowoc. That was a steel workers local. And West Bend, which was huge at that time, that was in West Bend, of course. And Regalware was in Kewaskum, just north of West Bend. So there was that whole area of pots and pans, which created, because they were able to bring aluminum ore into the ports at Manitowoc and Two Rivers, and then of course it was an easy shipment into West Bend and so forth.
Some of that's similar on the west side of Michigan in terms
of... Yes, exactly right. You are correct.
Some of the AIW facilities were in these cities in Michigan that had long before been lumber processing cities or whatever, and now were becoming foundries, forges, and metalworking plants.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered, just one other thing before we leave about the corruption...
Yeah, go ahead.
Is it fair to say that part of the story also on why the AIW was so successful, and I'm not trying to belittle the comments you made, because I think my experience with dealing with AIW people is similarly quite positive in the 70s and 80s, but also when I look at it more as a historian, the corruption charges for the AIW, especially the two I'm most familiar with, the New York City paper local cab driver business and the Chicago corruption,
sure,
were also rather modest in comparison to some of what had happened in a couple of the other unions, and of course especially with the Teamsters troubles.
Oh yeah, I mean, we were small potatoes. I mean, in that sense, yeah, it doesn't take the sting off of the corruption. And but no, you are correct.
Yeah, I don't mean small potatoes, but just there was the level of corruption was nowhere as significant as in some of the other unions.
No, I mean, and it was not it wasn't through the entire union. It was concentrated in the International Secretary Treasurer's office under Tony Doria, and in the Chicago area under Angelo Enciso, and in the Johnny Dio operation in New York City. But when you got into the locals like at Motor Wheel in, you know, East Lansing, or Lansing rather, or into a Briggs & Stratton, or the West Bend Company here in Wisconsin, or down in the foundries and A.E. Staley in Decatur. No, those were hardworking, you know, dedicated unionists who really, I mean, we had very low dues throughout this entire period, so nobody was getting rich. In fact, the story is told by the late Ray Taylor, who was my predecessor, in a sense, as editor of the international newspaper back when it was the UAWFL. Ray tells the story that at one point in the 40s, the resources, the assets of the international were kept in a cigar box, you know, in our headquarters above an Olson radio store on West Michigan Street in downtown Milwaukee. So, there was not a lot of chance for largesse anywhere, in that bunch.
Right. There were no big pension funds. There was no use of dues money to buy hotels or any of this sort of stuff.
No. And the only thing we did have was, of course, that insurance scheme where they mixed dues money with insurance money in the Chicago area with Angelo and Sisal. That was the end. I don't know how much he got out of that, to be honest with you, but he was a mobster, apparently, and I understood he was even indicted at once for murder. I don't know that for sure. I'd have to check it out.
So, Ken, you want to move on to the IUD, coordinated bargaining?
Do that. I think it's important to point out, which I think I pointed out last time, but I want to repeat, is that I believe the one thing Carl Grieventhal believed very strongly in was in educating members. And that was kind of, odd in a sense, because Carl, of course, had only about an eighth grade education, which was not, unusual for his generation, of course. But he saw the need for education within our union. And one of the first things he did was to hire Dick Humphreys from the School for Workers of the University of Wisconsin. And Dick was with us from probably 1959 or so to about 1967 or so. And he then went on to West Virginia University, where he, became quite well recognized, I believe.
That's when I got to know him, in the late 70s, whatever.
And he was well-regarded, as I recall.
Anyways, he was chosen to be an education director?
Yeah, right. And, I think I'd have to double-check this, but I believe he actually became, assistant to the president. And so at that point, too, he had a strong desire to provide, professional services out of the international office in the form of a research director. And we also hired, people to be time study people, because that was a big issue, mm-hmm. an industrial engineer. And so we always had that on staff, and they would go out and handle cases and go into plants and, when the union would work out an agreement where some expertise would be needed, the international guy would go out and, sit into whatever those negotiations were and oftentimes go into the plant. And and we worked very closely with the School for Workers out of Wisconsin, and to a lesser extent to places like where you were. And we did a little bit with University of Illinois, a labor education program. I forget that guy's name, and I've talked to him recently, too.
Ron Peters?
No, it wasn't Ron, but I know him, of course.
Oh, going back, Stan Rosen?
Stan Rosen, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, he's still around. I think he lives in Chicago and so.
I thought he went out to Arizona, but anyways.
You're right. That's where I last talked to him.
But he does. He was in Chicago for years along with Bill Adelman.
Right, exactly.
So go ahead.
Well, anyway, after, I forget, I'd have to go back and see who were the first research directors when they moved to Milwaukee. But eventually, we hired Ray McDonald, you know, and Ray came to us from the, I want to say machinist. He had been in a local, this you'd have to get from him.
Yeah.
And Ray came to us about 1970-71. Just a quick little aside, you know, he had never been in a cold climate. He was born in San Diego and was half Hispanic. And he got up here and he insisted he joined us in January, and was one of those colder winters we have up here occasionally.
Right, the old days.
Yeah, he refused to put on snow boots and or anything like that. He had to have his cowboy boots with their leather soles. And shit, he fell more often than you care to mention. Because,
yep.
You know, we had about 4 months of ice on our parking lot, you know. So, but anyway, he finally got smart. But that's, but anyway, Ray was a hard-hitting guy. I mean, you know, he kind of had to be in. So he was really good for the union. And then we hired Jeff McDonald, who was no relation, of course. And, you know, and Jeff had and gained great credentials as time went on. We always had real professionals in those jobs, and they were a nice bunch of people in the sense that, by and large, our members loved them, and because they basically came from working-class backgrounds. They weren't strictly college-educated, you know, guys that never had gotten their hands dirty. Although I think Jeff was... I don't think he ever came out of a real union that I recall, but he still had that, you know, spirit. So, and that was one of the other strengths of the AIW, was that while we were looking for experts in these areas, we were still very down-home based, you know, worker, a blue-collar oriented type of a staff, and who identified well with our own members and yet were able to do a professional job, you know, elsewhere. That's just that you can't prove that we're any better or any worse than any other union, but I tend to think we had a nice mix of, you know, of education and practical experience. Yeah, go ahead, Adam.
I was just going to say, and of course, that was part of my enjoyment of getting to know some AIW people in Michigan and then also people around the headquarters, was McDonald was here the first few years I was at MSU.
Right.
And then you stole him away, and he went to Milwaukee to work with Ray. But because of the new directions, health and safety, I came over several times for training, either in Milwaukee or Madison, related to getting new labor educators at unions and universities up to snuff and the level of the school for workers, and spent some time doing things with AIW because I was doing that here in Central and West Michigan, which also relates to, you also had some excellent folks in the health and safety area, too.
Yes, and actually when the Occupational Safety and Health Act was passed in 1971, we went out to get some of those new direction grants, and I think we got one of the early ones, and it was a fairly, you know, a fairly substantive one, and we hired Milan Racic, R-A-C-I-C, and who had been, I believe, Assistant Regional Director for OSHA in Chicago. and Milan really was an advocate for it, and then he was able to hire a couple of assistants. We had Dave Ortlieb, who's now mm-hmm. with the Steelworkers, and he's on my Facebook list.
I can't remember either.
Yeah, but he had a couple of assistants. You know, they weren't there at the same time.
And you also worked closely with the people from School for Workers who were on their New Directions OSHA grant.
Exactly right, and I think the Wisconsin combination there of our union and the School for Workers guys was particularly strong.
Mm-hmm.
John Lund was, you know, making a name for himself out of Madison. So,
With Neil DeClercq and Jay Johnston.
That's right. They were there, yeah.
And a female who was an industrial hygienist. Long time ago.
Yeah.
But there was many good staff there working for George Haglin was the labor
right.
educator director at the time.
Right. Right.
But my other memory was that George Statesman, who at that point must have become your education director.
Yeah, George joined us about the same time Ray did. And he came from the Teamsters School. He had been teaching down there. George has had a very interesting background. He died in 1991. But George was a crusader, and the sweetest guy you'd ever want to meet in the world. He always overtipped wait staff. He never wanted to. I mean, he would on certain enemies. He had his opinions, of course, but on otherwise, I mean, he was just a gentle man, and very dedicated. He and his wife had both been arrested for 6 months for defacing property in 1950, I believe it was, as part of a peace movement in New York City. And so he was a peacenik and a radical in that sense, a World War II vet who had, you know, fought in France and so forth. So, I mean, very interesting guy. And
for small staff, you had a very interesting group and very dedicated, like you said. So,
yeah, George was you know, really, and I you know, at his wake, I was asked to say a few words, and I called him there my conscience, because I'd been assistant to the international president, and, you know, had to, in a sense, basically, you know, run the union in the nuts and bolts part of it, and that meant making practical decisions, which not always were the most left-wing in his satisfaction, you know. So,
what were the years you were assistant?
I think it would probably be from about 1980 to 1992.
Uh-huh.
About 12 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And George always had brought in a civil rights mode into our educational sessions. And the one thing that one of the traditions we started probably under Humphreys, before I got there, and I got there in 68, was collective bargaining conferences. We would hold them throughout the country in, I believe it was every other year, every other year. It would be in our non-convention years. And we would hold them all over the country. They'd be 2 or 3 day sessions, and we'd go in and, you know, rent a hotel area where we'd have access to half a dozen, you know, breakout rooms and teach classes in everything from you know, and we'd have mock collective bargaining sessions and do the whole thing. And they were very popular and very well attended. Of course, we held them right in the general areas of where the locals were located. So they didn't have to stay overnight in hotels. And as I say, they were very popular. We did a number of things. The classes would be on various research issues into labor. George would always make sure that we had some civil rights stuff in there of you know, some sort. I recall he got on a kick at one point when there was a move to decrease the amount of incarcerations that were going on in the country. If you recall, during the 80s particularly, there was this, you know, throw them in and lock, you know, and throw away the key, you know, and the very punitive thing. So he had a whole series of conferences. I mean, he would always include some presentation in that area for that period of time. He did the same thing in trying to build a labor and environmental a coalition in order to build understanding with union members that it wasn't always wise just to oppose the environmentalists because you might endanger your job, you know, that whole situation. And out of that came another creation, and that was the Wisconsin Labor Environmental Network, which we became the leader on, and in the state of Wisconsin, and we're responsible, I think, largely for the fact that Wisconsin, at that time in the middle 80s, passed one of the earliest of the recycling laws, and we got that done largely because we were able to bring together the brewery workers and the steel workers who made, we had a number of can factories in Wisconsin at that time, and bring them all together with environmental groups, particularly the Sierra Club, to create a joint network. And because one of the things that the environmentalists were pushing at that time was deposit laws like you have in Michigan, and they were opposed to that, of course. And so we said, well, what's better than the deposit laws but recycling? And therefore, Wisconsin became quite a leader in it. Unfortunately, the current governor has already weakened some of those great innovations. But anyway, that was in the area of both civil rights and in various public issues and the environment. So in our own small way, wherever we were strong, we were able to help our locals build local coalitions within their communities on various issues. The other thing that we were very strong in, and that was part of what I was hired for originally, I was hired to do two jobs. One of them was to put out the International Union newspaper and do other public relations related stuff, and secondly, to run our COPE program, or our political action program. And we were a relatively small union to have somebody who was devoting that much time to political action. And we were among one of the unions that, on a per capita basis, probably, you know, raised about as much much money, you know, voluntary money through our COPE effort as any of the others.
How did you raise voluntary money?
Well, I mean, I used to, for instance, at our collective bargaining conferences, those folks had to hear me whether they wanted to hear me or not.
Okay.
And then I did a monthly newsletter strictly for On Political Action. We did various strategies to, and then we had competition, and of course the AFL-CIO, you know, we did subscribe totally to the AFL-CIO, you know, plan on that, and we were able, because we were strong in certain communities, we didn't have a great overall effect, like we were very strong in the Fort Wayne area, and I, you know, Birch Bayh, when he was senator, used to come by all the time. We were big in northwest Arkansas, and Bill Clinton's original campaign for Congress started in our union hall at Local 370 in Fort Smith. And there were that. We were, you know, large in Wisconsin, particularly Milwaukee, and, got to know most of the politicians, the senators and governors, who, of course, were labor-endorsed most of the time, through that process, largely because, you know, we would make a strong effort wherever, and we would target races, which is part of the AFL-CIO COPE operation, was they'd look at the 435 congressional races throughout the country and pick out those that were swing seats that we had a chance of winning. And very often that would include a place like Fort Wayne, which was kind of a swing area for the 4th Congressional District, and, and places like Decatur, Illinois, where Dick Durbin, the current Democratic Senate leader, started out, and I met him back when he was in his first term of Congress.
What plant did you have there?
I'm sorry?
What plant or local did you have?
Oh, we had a lot there. That was the A.E. Staley plant, which was the biggest. That's the corn processing, a factory. And we had ADM, which was, the prominent grain milling thing. Most of those were grain millers, but in Decatur, they were AIW. There were a number of foundries in Decatur at that time. So we were along with the rubber workers at Goodyear, and I believe steel at Cat there in Decatur. But we were the stronger, bigger union of all of them.
Were there ever examples, and I'm not trying to find them, but were there examples where you had conflict with the AFL-CIO choices on who you might endorse, and how did you handle when you did have that kind of conflict occasionally?
I'm trying to think back.
Maybe it never happened.
It may have happened at times where we like somebody in particular, but I don't remember anything really major. And if it comes to my mind,
that's okay.
As time goes on, I will certainly, try to do something about it.
So anyways, you part of your job at the beginning was to concentrate also on COPE political action activity, and so you did that in addition to the newspaper and other PR.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Is what you were doing. Can we drift back to the IUD?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So just to review, when the UAW was being run by Walter Reuther, he was also in his last 2 years before the merger head of the CIO following Phil Murray's death. And George Meany, coming out of the plumbers,
right,
was then head of the AFL because of the death of Bill Green.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1953, and the next couple of years of discussion of merging the AFL and the CIO, part of a compromise was that Meany would become the president of the merged union, and Reuther would not only have an office, a secondary office, but he would be in charge of a new industrial union department.
Yes.
And the AIW, though it had been an AFL, you've told me became very active within the AUD and worked with the other industrial unions, and that was going to get us into Ray McDonald and his involvement in these coordinated bargaining, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I did talk with Ray at some length the other day.
Okay.
And he, you know, first of all, he agrees that we were often, we believe more in the coordinated bargaining process than many of our sister unions. And it probably because we were the smaller union and could use the extra support from outside.
Mm-hmm.
So we were particularly interested in fostering that process. So we helped organize, and Ray and Jeff in particular, both of them, you know, worked very hard at fostering that process. You had been trying to figure out whether or not, in final analysis, an AIW auto parts contract was better from the workers' point of view than a UAW CIO contract. And Ray says he has no way of knowing that offhand. I mean, he's got anecdotal evidence and so forth, but nothing definitive. And what he said he would do, he would talk with Dick Proston, who, you know, for years worked at the IUD, and is a, he and Dick are close friends, and they live blocks apart down in Naples, Florida. And so he's going to look into it a little bit further.
Right.
So my suggestion is that anything further on that, you would probably want to get more from him.
Okay, call Ray.
Yeah.
I don't think I said that I thought they were better, but I thought that they probably were comparable to UAW CIO contracts or UAW AFL-CIO contracts in similar kind of size industries, locals, factories.
Well, yeah, right. I didn't mean to imply that you said they were otherwise. I mean, you know, so, no.
But...
But, I mean, he says it's not data to prove one way or the other, you know, or to prove anything, because it would be, take a lot of research, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. My thought was just, well, I'll look into this, but I am...
You know, one of the things that might be there in the files in Pittsburgh, and maybe over at the UAW in Solidarity House, are old minutes and files from those coordinated bargaining meetings, because they did go into a comparison of each plant's wages and benefits and conditions. So my guess is that buried in the files, you could see some hints over whether AIW plant in of Dana's and a UAW plant at Dana's had, you know, a similar or different, you know, standards.
Yeah. Part of what had triggered it for me, I don't know if... When I was doing some work at the Reuther Archives, I dug up a couple different things, and one was from an old AFL auto worker way back in May of 1941, and these were, of course, in the days where UAW AFL's competing with UAW CIO. And in the article of this May AFL auto worker of 1941, they did two columns, the wages of AFL and wages of CIO, grievance procedure of both, days off of both, strikes of both, different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure until the mid-50s, you would have in both sides, those kind of comparisons, as there was this competition going on. After that, it wouldn't be the competition, but just like you say, maybe minutes of IUD coordinated bargaining sessions might give us some comparisons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But my point was that my guess is that they, from years of being a labor educator, the work I did with small UAW locals, amalgamated locals, so on and so forth, part supplier locals, their contracts and their issues were not a whole lot different than AIW part supplier locals and their contracts and their issues.
I would, my guess is that you are correct. I mean, I think, for instance, compared to some of the smaller internationals that I had acquaintanceship is, this is, again, you can't prove it, but I'll bet you if you went through and compared the size of the staffs of professional staffs with a lot of these unions, our people, I think, got really far superior service in comparison with a number of the smaller unions. And I think, too, that the smaller locals within the big unions, like steel and auto and so forth, weren't always treated with the same respect as Local 600 in Detroit would be, you know.
Exactly. This had partly come up, my old standing interest in the part supplier interest, but then at the session that you and I did, and the excellent question from the audience about sort of, you know, why study the AIW, what were its accomplishments, why did members stick with the UAW AFL instead of going CIO, and we tried to make some statements about that. And so that kind of got us into some of this discussion of comparatives.
Sure.
So what else did Ray tell you in terms of what those sessions were like in the IUD coordinated bargaining efforts, and what were...
Well, I mean, we didn't go into that much detail. I mean, I do know from the time when, because we would talk about this back in the office back while we were working.
In the 80s?
Yeah, and of course I was very much aware of IUD stuff, and I was, you know, and so on and so forth. And so, I mean, I was just because of, anyway.
So, I mean, was part of the notion that you were doing research, well, not you as much as Jeff, or Ray, doing research on what different unions and locals for different unions who shared a common employer, not just what was in their contract, but what was going on in terms of production methods, future plans, all that kind of stuff?
Well, it got into, you know, what the employer was up to, you know, in other words, because a lot of the discussions involved what they might have been, what a certain plant might be doing in Jackson, Michigan, and then the one down in Evansville, Indiana, would be doing, you know. And sometimes they would say, well, they moved this human relations director from Evansville to Jackson, for instance, and he's this kind of an a-hole or not, or he's a good guy to work with or whatever. So they'd be sharing intelligence about management that they had to deal with. You know, maybe there was a new policy that a company came out with, and they may have tried it out in Decatur, Illinois, and then just to see how it would work, and that would be important to hear from the boys from Decatur as to what was going on, you know, because they may start that same process up in Battle Creek, you know. So that was a lot of it.
So,
and the hope was to build, one of the biggest goals was to build common expiration dates of contracts so that they would all close on June 30th or whatever, and they would be able to put some real pressure on the company because, of course, if a plant shut down and struck in Battle Creek, they might just move that work over to Fort Wayne. You know, I mean, that was the kind of thing that they were trying to achieve. They rarely achieved it,
Okay, that was my question.
And that was the ultimate goal. Now, Dick Proston is the real expert on that, I believe, and Ray's going to discuss that with him. So if you wanted to, at some point, set up a call like this with Ray and or Dick, that might be wise.
Appreciate it. Very helpful. So my sense is, in terms of historian and somewhat in talking, teaching some of these folks, in the 60s into the 70s, the unions were trying to improve their contracts, and some of the sharing would be what a union had achieved in one international or one locale and seeing if you could match it in others. But as we go through the 80s and into the 90s, it was somewhat the reverse.
Right, what you can hold on to. And so, I mean, that, and then, of course, we're facing plant closings because they were, you know, they'd be closing that place in Jackson, you know, and moving that work out. So the folks in Evansville, Indiana, might get a whole bunch of new work, and they'd be working overtime and making a ton of money. And then but you know, the handwriting was on the wall. Eventually, they're going to leave Evansville for Mexico or somewhere, you know.
Well, that was my sense of what much of Jeff McDonald's job became in the later 80s and into the 90s, was about plant closures and pension rights and those areas.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, that was, you know, one of the things that was most discouraging about this work. You were just picking up the crumbs at the end of the day, and that certainly was no fun.
Did you get involved in some of that? I mean, you wrote about it in
the
paper.
Oh, I wrote about it. I did a lot of stuff. I mean, for instance, I got involved a lot. For instance, we had a strike against Ohio Art in Bryan, Ohio, back in, and that was when Ohio Art was a, you know what they're famous for?
Ohio Art, A-R-T?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Etch-a-Sketch. They make
Etches,
but, and they developed the Etch-a-Sketch, which is still being sold to kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They have had a bunch of other toys, all made in Bryan, basically. And so we went on strike there. So I went down there because that was locally owned. The Ohio Art owner lived up in the big mansion on the hill in Bryan. It's just a classic story.
Okay.
And, of course, now they're making Etch-a-Sketch and everything else in China or somewhere over there, which is a shame. But anyway, I would go in, and we put together a special tabloid, four-page tabloid, exposing the plant manager and all. This was a campaign to win over local people, and, you know, we did a lot of stuff like that. So, and I got involved in Springfield, Illinois, when we had the Royal Typewriter strike in 69, and I did a lot of work in Fort Smith, Arkansas, over some problems we had at the giant Whirlpool plant there. So we would go in and do a lot of that kind of support in things. We had a nationwide boycott on Whirlpool products during our troubles there, and we got support from the AFL-CIO, and we used to organize stuff outside of Sears stores. We were trying to get Sears to stop selling Whirlpool.
So what would your role be? What did you do?
Well, I kind of helped organize a lot of that stuff. I ended up going down to Whirlpool and getting them set up so they could put out a three times a week newsletter to their members, and talking to the local media and doing all sorts of stuff like that. And we had 6,000 members down there, or it was 6,000 plant. It was, of course, open shop, and I think we were about 70-75% organized.
Where was that one?
Whirlpool in Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Okay.
They just closed that plant last year. They had moved most of their Whirlpool, Whirlpool started in Benton Harbor.
Right.
And then he moved to Fort Smith. And we organized them back in the 60s when they moved down. And it was largely because of Walt Campbell and I don't know what, I forget who, because it was before my time. But that's when they left Benton Harbor. And then it ended up in Fort Smith. And we got them organized. And we were chasing plants when the old Fruhoff trailer, which is no longer in business, we had virtually every Fruhoff plant organized throughout the country. And in fact, we were, I think, one of the biggest unions in truck trailer manufacturing. And so we chased the plant down to Charlotte, because I went in and bargained. I went in and bargained the termination contract or the shutdown contract at Avon Lake, Ohio, when they shut down that plant of 1,200 people back in 69. And we got hiring rights. We get jobs for about 200 people down there in Charlotte, and we're able to build a local out of it. But fun 24 years, I'll tell you. There was never a dull moment.
Would this be a good point to call halt for today and come back next time, and I'd ask you about some more of these local stories and some of the other firms in your role?
Yeah, I don't know how many I got left, John, but we can do it at least one more time. Sure.
Okay. I was thinking, so I've got this list of, I keep going back to the special issue you did of the AIW, a proud union.
Uh-huh.
And on the back page, I put it in the visuals that I showed at our event, and on the back page it has some major firms with AIW members, mm-hmm. and so it mentions things like Whirlpool at Fort Smith. That was the Bill Clinton connection, right? It was because of that?
Yeah, that was, he came in and started local 370 Hall there. I spent half a lifetime, it seems, in that hall.
So I thought if we started there with some more of those stories and your involvement during your years, and then anything else we wanted to say about innovations reaching members or community, and then your kind of recollections as an, I don't want to say outsider, but no longer leader in terms of the mergers, we would wrap it up then at the next one.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think I've probably said as much. I mean, I'd have to do a hell of a lot of research, which, I mean, I think the research now, you've got the key tapes, both from Dom and Gabe and now Les, and you've got that thing that Herb Rotslaw wrote, which I sent to you.
Right.
And so there's plenty of research, and now the job is going down and diving into the archives, I guess.
So I will email with you, and we'll set up a time in a couple of weeks. And, if you don't need to do a lot of research but just looked at that list of firms, and you'd remember some of those kind of stories. But I thought we could, there might be a little bit more to say about health and safety or bargaining.
I should call Milan. He's right here in Milwaukee.
Okay. Also in terms of some of this activity of what you actually did in terms of boycotts, local union newsletters, that kind of thing, in some of those different places.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. All righty.
So that would be wonderful. I would ask that two other quick things. One was that I did send you another permission form, and it would be nice if you would send me signed again with today's date and the last date's time.
Well, I did send you that.
Okay.
That was in that. Didn't I send you a letter the other day?
Maybe I didn't get it yet.
Okay. Yeah, that's. I don't. So you want one for today?
Well, yeah. I guess they like them here, so. You can hold on to it to when we do the next one and put both dates on it.
Okay.
The related issue, though, that was a question, is there any chance we could find any relative of Les Washburn so that they could, they would take a grandchild,
right.
I think anybody who is a blood relative could sign off to give permission to have your interview with Les posted here with the other things, and it would be a nice compliment to our interviews and sessions.
Yeah, he's more colorful.
Well, I didn't mean that at all.
No, he really was.
But the interview you did with him is great stuff, and they would like to have, but it doesn't have to be him or a wife. It could be a child or grandchild or somebody else who could say, sure, we have no reason this can't be
I'll
put.
I'll see if I can search out that phone number I had when I talked to his son 20 years ago.
You had anything, I mean, I would clearly mail it to them or do anything to, you know, call up that would be appropriate that you recommend, but it would be nice if you could make that initial contact.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it. That's the biggest issue. And if I can find my notes from then.
Or if you even could remind me, you know, what city and what name to look for. I don't want to put too much burden on you, but.
Well, actually, the unfortunate thing is I think he only had daughters, I think. But anyway, so this would be a son-in-law, so the last name would not be Washburn.
I think that's good. I mean, I can't.
But if I can find it, that's the biggest issue.
Yeah.
Okay.
So thank you very much, and we'll be in touch. And I don't know if you do anything for St. Paddy's Day, but whatever you do or don't do, have a good one.
Okay, thank you. You too, John.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye.